listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin lawmaker who wants the state to stop paying hunters whose dogs are killed by wolves.
Right now, we continue our series of interviews with the candidates running to become Wisconsin's next Supreme Court justice.
Three candidates will be on the ballot on February 20th, but only two will move on to the general election on April 3rd. All candidates are running to replace Justice Michael Gableman, who announced last year that he would step down after his current tenure term ends.
We're talking with each of the candidates this week. We turn now to Rebecca Dallet. She's a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge and one of the three candidates running for Wisconsin's Supreme Court. Judge Dallet, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, why are you running for a seat on Wisconsin's highest court?
I am running because we are at a time when our rights are under attack every day, tweet by tweet, and we have a broken Supreme Court. And we need someone with values and experience to step up and repair that court. And I am currently a judge for almost a decade, a prosecutor before that for more than a decade. I've worked for over 20 years in our courts, protecting the vulnerable, fighting for our rights, and I want to keep doing that on our Wisconsin Supreme Court.
That's the experience side of thing. You mentioned the values, and the issue of politics on the state Supreme Court has come up a lot in this election and past ones. One of your opponents in this primary has been very vocal about his affiliation, how that might influence his work as a justice. What are your views on the role of politics in the role of a judge?
Well, I think it's important that the voters do know my values, and I'm happy to share those values with them. I care about clean air and water. I care about having great public schools, workers' rights, equal protection under the law, women's rights. Those are my values. But as a judge, I know that I can't take positions on cases before they come in front of the court. And we need to make sure that our judges are fair and impartial. We need to make sure when people go in front of a judge or justice that they think they're going to get a fair shake, that they know they're going to get a fair shake. And when you come out taking positions on issues, pre-deciding cases, you risk that fairness that we all demand from our courts that we're missing right now. And we need to get back to that.
Well, it seems like a fine line there. If you say you value clean water, for example, if there's a water pollution case that came before the Supreme Court, argued on its merits on both sides, would the person who'd maybe been fined or a company that had been fined for an alleged clean water violation, would they look and say, well, she says she values clean water. We think that means she's going to be biased against us.
Well, you're getting to exactly the heart of it. It's very different to express a personal value and to still be able to be fair and impartial, to know what it's like. And I'm the only candidate that has 10 years of knowing what it's like to apply the law and apply it to the facts of the case. That's very different than coming out and making specific statements about specific legislation, for example, which is what Mr. Burns has done. That is a situation where someone might ask you to recuse yourself. But we do all have values. That's true. As I said before, as I started, we can share those values. I'm happy to do that. I also am really the only one that understands in this race the need to put politics aside and to make sure that we elect someone who is going to be fair and impartial. It's not progressive to make statements on cases and to give people a sense that you're not going to be able to be fair. That's not justice. That's not progressive.
The way these races go, they're nonpartisan races, but it usually comes down to there's one candidate who's backed by all the Republicans and the Republican Party apparatus. There's one candidate who's backed by the Democrats. Clearly, both sides see something in a candidate that suggests they're going to be sympathetic. Are we just kind of winking at this nonpartisan idea?
Well, I don't believe it's winking. I believe that we have a vision here in our Wisconsin courts. The vision was from 100 years ago from Bob La Follette. It's progressive to have nonpartisan courts, and it's something that we all need to make sure that we keep. And we need to make sure that the people that we're electing, the leaders that we're electing, including our Supreme Court justices, are able to be fair and impartial. We do have a situation right now where we have a candidate, and that is Judge Scrinock, who is made it clear by his actions, by his statements, that he will just be a rubber stamp for our governor and our legislature. That is something we have had, unfortunately, for the last 10 years. And we have had the special interest money buying justice or a justice, and we need to get away from that. We need to get back to the people making a decision on a justice who is going to be fair and impartial and not just a rubber stamp for our legislature or our governor.
We're talking to Judge Rebecca Dallet, candidate for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. Earlier, Judge Dallet, you mentioned recusals. When is it appropriate or necessary even for a Supreme Court justice to recuse her or himself?
Well, this is a symptom of a system that's broken. When I talk about a broken Supreme Court, we can look to our lack of recusal. And we look specifically to the John Doe case. And that was a case where $2.25 million was sent by a special interest group on Justice Gableman's campaign to buy a justice, and then appeared in front of him as a party to the case, the organization that spent that money. And Justice Gableman was asked to recuse himself, and he refused to do that. That is a symptom of a system that's broken. We need to get a strong recusal rule, something that's meaningful so that the public can have confidence that justices and judges are going to be fair. And that's something I've been talking about throughout the campaign from the very beginning, the need to really get back to restoring confidence in our leaders, trust in our courts. We can only do that with electing someone who has the values and experience, and I'm the only candidate that has over 20 years, over 10,000 cases working in our courts. I'm also endorsed by more than 200 judges right now, people that know our courts, are endorsing me because they know that I'm the one that can do this job.
I'd like to ask your thoughts about civility on the court, on Wisconsin State Supreme Court in particular. There have been well-publicized problems in the past. It's a little quieter now. How would you contribute to a civil atmosphere if you were elected?
Well, I think that distinguishes me from my opponents as well because I am someone who can work with others. I know what it's like having managed a courtroom, having managed attorneys and jurors for 10 years now. I know what it's like to disagree with someone, but to be able to get along with them. And that's an important part of making sure that we have faith in our courts as well, is that civility. In looking at Mr. Burns, the way he's acted throughout the campaign, his blatant statements that he's not planning on working with anyone, that he's looking to the future, when he can get the court where he thinks somehow he's going to be able to do, and not looking to today, and actually August 1st when this term starts. I will start this term on August 1st, certainly protecting our rights and values that make Wisconsin great, but also with an ability to work with the people that are on that court to do the best we can for the people of our state.
Getting back to values and politics, your first campaign ad targets the values of the sitting American president, President Trump. Why was that an important statement for you to make?
Well, we've been talking about the state of our country, the state of our state right now. I think it's important for all of us to understand where we are right now. We're at a moment in time where we are feeling threatened. All of the values that I've talked about, the clean air and water and equal protection and women are under attack. And this is something we all feel and we all relate to. And I'm the candidate that is going to be able to protect those values at this critical time. And there is just too much at stake right now to have someone without the experience needed to advocate for the policies that need to be changed and to make sure to protect those values through the decision-making of the court.
Some people have looked at that ad and said, well, isn't this kind of an overt political statement for a Supreme Court candidate to be targeting the Republican president of the United States?
This ad is talking about values, and it is something I've been talking about from the very beginning. It is the same message that I've had from day one of this campaign, and it is important that we look at this all in the context of the world that we're living in. I think in addition, when we look at the moment in time we have here for women, women have been under attack, and women are finally feeling strong enough and safe enough to be able to speak out against the harassment that women have suffered for years. And as a woman candidate, as someone who has experience both through watching in court and my own experiences not having a level playing field, I think it's really important to make sure that that playing field is leveled and that we recognize that here in our state of Wisconsin, that only of all the judges we have in the entire state, 1 in 5 are women. So that is another thing that we need to make sure to keep in mind. This is about the time we're living in, and this is about the values we care about and leveling the playing field for everyone in our state.
Can you leave us with just a few thoughts for voters on the primary election day, February 20th?
Well, this is an important day. This is an important seat. I would encourage everyone to get out and vote on February 20th. This seat really is a place where we can protect those values and rights that make Wisconsin great. And we can do that by electing someone with the values and experience, by electing someone who has spent, I have spent my entire career working for the people of our state in public service, not in corporate boardrooms, but in the courtrooms, fighting every day for all of us here in Wisconsin. I ask the voters to elect experience and values to elect me.
Judge Dallet, thanks for joining us today.
All right, thank you so much for having me.
Rebecca Dallet is Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge, one of three candidates running for Wisconsin's Supreme Court. We talked to Sauk County Circuit Court Judge Michael Skrenek on Tuesday and Madison-based attorney Tim Burns yesterday, both of them also running for the seat. If you missed any of these interviews, we'll have them all posted online over at wisconsinvote.org.
Wisconsin has paid more than $700,000 to hunters for dogs that were killed by wolves since 1985, according to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
If a hunter believes their dog has been injured or killed by a wolf, the case is investigated by the USDA Wildlife Service. The DNR policy does not compensate hunters if their dogs are killed by other wildlife, only wolves.
State Senator Fred Risser has introduced a proposal to end the compensation program. He's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 26th Senate District, which includes the city of Madison and Shorewood Hills. Senator Risser, welcome back to Central Time.
Welcome. Thanks for having me on your program.
So why do you want to end the process of paying hunters for dogs killed by wolves?
That's a good question. I just don't think society should be responsible for compensating owners of hunting dogs that are injured or killed by wolves. You know, if a hunter wants to protect his dogs against such costs, he could take out insurance.
And so why was that this original policy put into place? You've been in the legislature for a while. What was the thought process behind it?
Well, I wasn't part of the thought process, so I really don't know, except that the legislature is controlled by gun interests, and I suppose that those people just decided that was another idea. I just don't think that, as I say, society should be responsible for this, and that insurance is a good way of handling it if someone is worried about it.
Now, this isn't the first time you've introduced a bill like this. Do you think this year could be any different?
Well, it's kind of late in the session, and quite honestly, it doesn't look like it's moving very fast. But I've gotten a number of co-sponsors to the bill, and maybe next time around we'll be able to get over the hump.
And who are some of the people who have signed on to this with you?
Well, a number of people in both the Senate and the Assembly have. The bill is still in circulation, so there still may be more that will sign. I think I have about 7 signatures so far.
And Senator Risser, you represent, kind of the Madison area in the state Senate. I don't have wolf numbers in front of me for this area, but it seems as though this could be something that would be a bigger issue in the northern part of the state, more rural parts of the area. Do you think that some constituents in the rest of the part of the state might think that this is state versus Madison a little bit?
No, I think it's a question of what is society's responsibility? And is society responsible for compensating owners of hunting dogs that are injured or killed by wolves? I don't think they are. I don't know why the taxpayers should pick that up. As I say, we have insurance that can protect the person if they want to protect their hunting dogs in this way. I guess it's a philosophical belief as how far should society go, and are we responsible for those injuries.
And have you heard from any of your constituents that say, hey, we don't want this to be part of state policy anymore?
most of my constituents like the idea that I've introduced. And so, quite honestly, information and literature I've gotten from constituents are supportive of what I'm doing.
I want to, we're talking to State Senator Fred Risser right now. He's introduced a proposal that would end a state a policy that would reimburse hunters whose dogs are killed by wolves and wolves only. And I want to go to a caller really quickly. We have Richard in Ettrick. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm well. What'd you have to say?
I guess I'm against the senator's policy that he's introducing. I don't have hunting dogs in the north, but I'm a rancher and I have cattle and things, and it's kind of the same deal. There's no other recourse for a person, you know, that loses an animal due to wolf depredation because you can't shoot the wolf, and the state can't do anything with it. So the only recourse is to put in for a claim. But I guess if they would say, hey, I can't shoot a wolf that's attacking my cattle, I guess, you know, we go back to the old adage, shoot, shovel, and shut up.
Richard, thank you so much for that call. So Richard, who is a rancher, is hitting on another part of this, which has been part of the debate for a while, which is what do people livestock do in this situation?
Let me emphasize, this bill does not eliminate payments to people whose pets or livestock have been killed or injured by wolves. Your rancher friend is covered, and this bill does not in any way take compensation away from, as they say, livestock or pets that are killed by wolves. This is applies only to those people who put their dogs in harm's way and send them into the wilds to compensate them for being killed by wolves. I just don't think that the taxpayers need to go that far. I'm in no way trying to limit compensation to livestock or things of that type.
And so do you think that there might be a little bit of, not misinformation, but not full understanding of the proposal that you have, that you've been introducing in the legislature?
I suspect if someone does not read the content of the bill or know what it is, they're fearful that I'm taking all compensation away. That is not true. In fact, I'm taking a very limited amount of compensation away. I'm just affecting those people who put their hunting dogs in harm's way voluntarily. I don't in any way want to cut the compensation for those people who are have their livestock injured by wolves. And this bill does not affect that at all.
This is an issue that people have extremely strong opinions about throughout the state. Is there any concern that if we ended this compensation, would it potentially hurt support for wolf conservation?
Well, the DNR determines whether or not the wolves should be listed as endangered species. And I suspect if they were taken off the endangered species list, that the situation would be different. But currently, they're listed federally as endangered species. And as long as they're endangered species, I think they should be treated a little differently than if they were causing problems.
In 2017, Wisconsin paid close to $100,000 to hunters whose dogs were killed by wolves. It's a record compared to previous years. You know, is there any explanation as to why there was an uptick?
You know, this is one of the things that bothers me. The amount of compensation has doubled, more than doubled in just 1 year. Now, there must be some reason for that, and I don't know what it is. But if it can double in 1 year, maybe it'll double again the next year. And I don't know what the reason is. But again, is it the taxpayer's responsibility to take over this task? We taxpayers take over a number of tasks. Maybe philosophically it is, but in my opinion, it is not.
I want to go to one more caller really quickly. We have Dan in Appleton. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. What did you have to say on this?
I guess I really had to say hats off. My understanding is the speaker is a Democrat, and this is generally more of a libertarian sort of position. And so I guess this kind of warms my heart to see somebody saying, you know what, why should the taxpayer fund somebody else's hobby when they have absolutely no skin in the game of hunting. You know, again, that would be like somebody saying, you know, if I go skiing, somebody should be responsible for fixing any broken skis, legs, et cetera.
All right, Dan, thank you so much for that call. In about the minute that we have left, Senator Risser, what do you say about it does echo some stuff that you've said throughout the interview.
I think the caller expresses himself very well, and I appreciate the call. And that's my opinion. I just think that there's a limit to what the taxpayers should take over. And in this case, individuals are voluntarily putting their hunting dogs in harm's way. And I just don't think that the taxpayers, in that case, should take over the responsibility of what happens.
Senator Risser, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Fred Risser is a Democratic state senator from the Madison area. He joined us to talk about a proposed measure that would end payments to hunters for dogs killed by wolves. Really quickly want to remind them that in the bill, it doesn't apply to cattle, so it's just dogs and wolves.
First, with France's Bastille Day as a model, President Trump is planning a grand military parade in Washington, D.C. with soldiers and tanks. The idea goes rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue.
If a military parade were to happen, it would be the first in the United States since the 1991 parade celebrating the end of the Gulf War.
Peter Fever is with us now. He's a professor of political science and public policy at Duke University and an expert in civil-military relations. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
We don't have a lot of detail on what this parade might be or when it would happen, but it is apparently maybe in the works. First of all, basically, what do you make of this concept?
Well, Americans love their military, and the military plays the symbolic role in our society of being the touchstone when we're looking to come together and transcend barriers and transcend divisions. And we use it at moments of high civic religion, like the Super Bowl and sporting events and things like that. We use military symbols, military honor guards. Medal of Honor recipients were the ones who flipped the coin at the Super Bowl, and there was a flyover of the Air Force jets. And so this is a common thing. So on the one hand, it's understandable that the president is reaching for this as a something that should, he's arguing, appeal to all Americans. On the other hand, it's not typical that we do a military parade with lots of the hardware. So we usually honor the troops. Veterans will march or active duty will march, but not with the tanks, not with the artillery, not with the heavy pieces that are more customary in other cultures. And so I think that it's that dimension, of course, that the president's most interested in, and that's the dimension that is setting some of his critics' teeth on edge.
And that's a model that a wide range of countries do it, from places like France, as we mentioned, but also, and the president's critics have been pointing toward this, places like North Korea, Russia, the Soviet Union back in the day. Do you worry if that's the model and the hardware is rolling down the street, the tanks and the artillery and the warplanes flying over, does that take us into some weird territory?
Well, first of all, I think a lot of Americans will enjoy the spectacle, including the president's base. I think it'll go over very well with him. And I think a lot of other Americans who are maybe not politically engaged will just find it interesting to see military hardware presented in that way. At the same time, the comparisons to North Korea and other unsavory states will be inescapable. And for anyone who misses it, I'm quite sure cable TV will do some side viewings to draw the comparison more sharply for our the viewers. And so I do think it's the kind of thing that can be easily overdone. It can easily come off as cheesy or worse, and can backfire, maybe not with the president's base, but with folks in the middle. And, of course, his critics will hate it, will hate every moment of it. Even if they are strongly supportive of the military, they'll hate the perceived politicization of the military for this purpose.
want to give a listen to Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders talking yesterday about the idea of a parade.
Nothing has been decided or locked in stone. This is in the early discussion phases, and it's something the president is looking at, not just a way that he can, but that the entire country can come together and show support and honor our military.
This is a fine line for politicians all the time, isn't it? Where is the line between publicly honoring the military and a politician using the military as a prop?
Well, every politician has fallen victim to the temptation to, not every politician, but every president has fallen victim to the temptation to use the military as a prop. Sometimes they're derisively called by the military themselves wallpaper. They're put up behind the president, not any president, not just the current president, while the president makes a policy announcement. And they're back there in the visual, and we know they won't boo. We know they won't misbehave. It will be a respectful hearing, and it can be assembled at the last minute and easily controlled for security reasons. And so from an advance point of view, from just a media management point of view, they're a favorite audience for presidents. But for precisely that reason, they end up getting used for times when it would not be appropriate, when it's not really a military or national security question, but more of a political issue that's being discussed. And when you do that, you're chipping away at the image of the military as nonpartisan, above politics, so willing to serve whoever is president, and sworn to uphold the Constitution and thus respecting the office of the president and not the person of the president. Their loyalty is not to the person of the president, it's to the office of the president. And these are fine lines to be worried about. And of course, in this, what makes this particular proposal so difficult is there doesn't appear to be a thing that's triggering it. There's not a recent victory that's triggering it. So the last time we had something like this was in Desert Storm. Well, that was a great victory, at least at the time it looked like a great victory. And it was also a moment to celebrate the end of the Cold War, which was another great victory. And so that parade, it seemed, even though it was controversial and some people think it was a mistake, nevertheless, there at least was a logic to it. The question is, what would we be celebrating now? What's the moment to be remembering it? And the White House, I think, has not yet fixed upon what that would be. And until they do, it's going to look more odd than they intend it to look.
Peter Fever is with us from Duke University. We're looking at the president's call for a military parade with lots of military hardware. Let's go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. You know, looking at the character of this president and his nature, I think this is really all about him. And as always, he kind of controls the narrative, so he's making it about patriotism, and so if you oppose this, somehow you're anti-military. We honor the military in every small town in America on Memorial Day and Veterans Day and the 4th of July with color guards and things like that, and I think this money could be better spent taking care of the veterans, their health care. You know, the suicide rate of veterans is deplorable, and spend the money on that. But this is all about Donald Trump's ego. He wants to be like the other leaders in the world with these big military parades, and it's against the traditions of the United States, too. Everyone knows that we have the most powerful military in the world. We don't need to parade it down our streets like the Russians do or the North Koreans do.
Willem, thanks for the call. Peter, what do you think?
Well, the caller raises an important sticking point, which is the cost. If it's just marching the band and some soldiers, well, it won't cost a lot of money. It's easy to put together. But that's not what the president seems to have in mind. What he has in mind is something much grander. That could be very expensive. And at that point, he needs congressional authorization to spend that money, and the opportunity cost, as the caller suggested, becomes rather pointed. Why spend the money here when the military have a whole lot of other priorities, readiness priorities, new weapon systems priorities, And when veterans have their own health care priorities that could use more funding. And so there is that question of why spend the money here when it could be better spent elsewhere. And I think the White House is going to have to return to that question in order to persuade Congress to authorize the funding for it.
Talk about the idea of a military parade in the nation's capital with Peter Fever from Duke University.
And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea? Should we have a U.S. military parade? Do you have any suggestions for other ways the U.S. could show support for the military and for veterans and active service members? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. Back to your calls. Kent is on the line in Reedstown. Kent, hi.
Yeah, hi. I think we almost worship the military. You know, they should be respected. It's our leaders that just trump it up. And speaking of Trump, I mean, you know, these people just want to use the military at the drop of a hat without knowing what they're doing. And we need to think about the military expense. We spend way too much money on it.
Kent, thanks for the call. A lot there, Peter. Respect, he says, but don't blur into worshiping the military.
I do worry about that. I have a lot of respect for the military. I served in the military myself. But I do think that we miss an opportunity to give due deference to other forms of service, not just military service. And there's this idea of thank you for your service, where we thank the military for the service. And I think that's right and appropriate to do. But I would like to see that extended to first responders, to people who work in emergency care, people who help care for elderly in hospices, people who are working with special needs children, things like that, which are very tough jobs that society needs done. We should be thanking them for their service as well. Obviously, what the military does, they risk their lives. It's noble, and it deserves society's thanks, and I'm glad we're doing it. But they're not the only jobs that deserve it. And I do share a little bit of the caller's concern that as a society, we've gotten comfortable thanking only one of the groups that needs to be thanked when there's many others that need the recognition or deserve the recognition.
Thanks for your call. Go next to Gene in Fond du Lac. Gene, hi.
Yes, sir.
What did you want to tell us about, Gene?
I'm a retired Marine Corps officer, and Marines really aren't keen on marching in parades to begin with. We consider them just dog and pony shows, unless you're honoring or rendering honors to someone as part of their ceremony, be it a retirement or a medal ceremony or something like that. But just the logistics of moving that amount of equipment into place to do something like that is just, it will be very expensive. And something to point out, I mean, Anwar Sadat was killed during a military parade review. You know, so it's always been adverse to have that type of thing happen in the U.S. military. We don't do it that way.
Gene, thanks for the call. Peter, people in the military aren't necessarily big fans of participating in these things, Gene says.
Well, you have to ask, where did the leak come from for this story? You know, you heard in your, at the top of the segment, you quoted the White House press spokesperson, and she said, well, it's still in the early stages. Well, I'm quite confident the White House did not leak this story. It's premature for them to see it discussed in public. So you want to know, well, who leaked it? Maybe it was somebody who thought it was a bad idea. And maybe that was someone in the military who had been asked to start doing the planning. I do think if the president's going, if the president wants it and he's determined to have it, and we know he does want it and is determined to have it, he's wanted to have it since the inauguration. At the end of the day, it's hard to say no to the president on something like this. Lives won't be put at risk. There'll be money spent, but it's not going to risk lives, and so it's the president's likely to get it. So then the question is, under what conditions would it be the most appropriate? And I think if we're going to do it, let's do it on November 11th, 2018, on the the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One, and use it to mark America's century of being a global leader. And the military played a major role in that, not just World War One, but World War Two and subsequent wars. There's a way of giving it symbolic meaning so it won't feel quite so out of phase, so odd. And I suspect that they'll settle on something like that that would make it a little bit more sensible.
Peter, end of World War One, end of World War Two, a clear victory, a clear moment to celebrate wars, Vietnam, Korea for that matter, Afghanistan, Iraq, they keep going. There's not a clear we won moment. Is it hard to say when we celebrate, to when we have this big ceremony?
Well, I think that's exactly why President H.W. Bush had a big parade at the end of Desert Storm. He was making up for the fact that there were no such parades at the end of Vietnam, and that the military may have received blame for fighting in a war that they didn't pick, that political leaders picked, and somehow American people blamed the military for it. And so I think the parade in 1991 was partly to atone maybe for the way the military was treated after Vietnam. But you're right, the current wars that we're in are still, they don't have a clean ending. They don't have a Battleship Missouri moment where it's clearly over. And that's why doing a parade is hard to peg to something. That's in fact why I suggested the 100th anniversary of World War One's ending, because that at least is a clean, obvious landmark to identify.
Peter, very briefly, is this conversation in some ways a distraction from the needs of the military you're talking about, the decisions we have, upgrading the nuclear arsenal that the president is talking about? Should we be talking about those things more than this idea of a parade?
Absolutely. In terms of American military, the much bigger news is not the parade. It's the fact that Senate passed a funding bill that would give them 2 years of predictable funding at levels that are closer to what they need. And that's a much bigger story, much better news for the American military than anything, any parade.
We'll leave it there, Peter. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Peter Feaver. He's a professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. He joined us for a look at plans for a military parade in the nation's capital. You can keep weighing in on this, by the way. Share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
The USA's Olympic curling team this year is dominated by upper Midwesterners. Most of them come from the Duluth Curling Club, and one athlete is based in St. Paul. There are also three competitors from the Madison Curling Club. As Maureen McCollum reports, it's a place with a long history of cultivating Olympic qualifiers.
Nina Roth works as a full-time nurse in the Madison area, but she's had her hours cut way back for a good reason. She's leading Team USA in women's curling, a sport she took up when she was 10.
Took 20 years, but that's normal in curling, and I'm just ecstatic.
In curling, players take turns lunging down a sheet of ice while pushing a rock that's about 40 pounds. They sweep the ice with a special broom to help glide the rock to a target, known as the house. The team that has rocks closest to the center of the house gets the points. It's similar to shuffleboard or even bocce ball. Roth is the skip on the women's Olympic team, which is kind of like the captain. Curling may look like a zen sport, but at the U.S. Olympic team trials on NBC, you can hear Roth and her teammates yelling their strategy at one another.
Yep. All the way. Hard.
Yep.
Hurry.
Oh.
Hard. Gotta go. Atta girl. Roll that out.
We are placing the broom so that our teammates have something to aim at. We are calling the strategy. So depending on where the other team is placing their rocks, we are making offensive or defensive moves based on that. And it's a big responsibility, but it's great.
Roth practices throwing rocks one afternoon at the Madison Curling Club. This place is like her second home.
Growing up in Madison, we have a lot of Olympic curlers who have come through this club. So I grew up playing with a bunch of them and admiring them, and some of them were actually my coaches. I was very, very fortunate. So to finally be an Olympian along with them is really, really cool.
Another first-time Olympian is Roth's teammate, Becca Hamilton. The two have curled together since they were teenagers.
Yeah, once I was drug out on the ice, I didn't look back. I was down here every single day before school, after school, playing in multiple leagues a night. And I was hooked. So
Becca isn't the only Hamilton heading to Pyeongchang. Her brother, Matt, is competing on the men's curling team. And together, Matt and Becca Hamilton are competing in the brand new Olympic event, mixed doubles curling.
About 4 years ago, they announced that it was going to be an Olympic sport, and that's when me and Becca kind of metaphorically stood back and looked at each other and were like, yeah, this is something we got to do, because the brother-sister thing, we're going to have an advantage as far as what we know about each other and how we play. So, yeah, it was kind of a no-brainer.
The Hamiltons have been getting a lot of attention outside of Madison. Here they are on NBC's The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon.
So it is my honor to introduce two of the best curlers in the world. Please give a warm Tonight Show welcome to U.S. Olympic curling team superstars and real-life siblings, Becca and Matt Hamilton, ladies and gentlemen.
And with the attention comes more money. Team USA's curlers have received corporate sponsorships, and they've even appeared in advertisements. This is huge for the athletes, since travel and equipment can be really expensive. Becca Hamilton works for Dick's Sporting Goods. Matt Hamilton tests home appliances for Spectrum Brands. The sponsorships also help make up for the fact that they're missing a month of work to go to the Olympics.
And then also all the time and effort we're putting into training, and if we're not at work, it helps, I guess, just get by on a day-to-day basis. For a lot of curlers from different countries, this is their job, so they get a salary to curl, where we don't get that yet in the U.S. So
that would be just dreamy.
Then the Hamiltons, along with Nina Roth, could focus their time on curling and training the next generation of Olympians who come through the Madison Curling Club. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The opening ceremony is tomorrow, but competition is already underway. Here's a spoiler alert if you want to watch it later. Matt and Becca Hamilton won their first mixed doubles match earlier today, defeating Russian athletes 9-3, but later on they lost their second match to Canada 4-6.
To learn more about all of Wisconsin's Olympic athletes and to see how they're doing, you can go to WPR.org/Olympics.
And tomorrow on Central Time, a Wisconsin Olympic athlete gives us a behind-the-scenes look at Nordic combined skiing. That plus Food Friday coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.